And I say no, just like the war with Iraq isn't about getting to Iraqi oil. This war in Iraq and this war in Iran, in my opinion, is about domestic American politics. This is about the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party, which is a minority, A, finding a vehicle to seize power, and B, finding a vehicle to sustain their seizure of power. The vehicle to seize power was Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Remember, the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party was the best friend of Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, because it made sense, because they didn't have to worry about Saddam as evil, because they had the evil empire, the Soviet Union, out there as a vehicle of empowerment. But now the evil empire went away. They tried in 1992, Paul Wolfowitz, Scooter Libby, to write a document which was a draft for the national security strategy of the United States of America, speaking of the need of the United States to step into the vacuum created by the collapse of the Soviet Union to basically dominate the world, to slice the world up into regions of national interest, and then to preemptively, if necessary, control the actions in those areas. The Middle East was a region of national interest based upon oil and the security of Israel, the need to secure Israel. The threat in the Middle East came from regimes that were unstable, regimes that were undemocratic in nature. Fortunately, a draft of this document was leaked to the press, and at that time we still had a press willing to report bad news, and a president who was responsible enough to say that this is unconstitutional, and that plan went away. Bill Clinton got elected, a Democrat, and the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party went and festered in neoconservative think tanks. They created their own little neoconservative movements, the Project for a New American Century, which in 1996, 1997, after spending 3 years writing briefings for the Likud Party in Israel, turned around and created something called the Project for a New American Century, published their document, their defining document, in which they basically put forward the plan that Wolfowitz and Scooter Libby wrote in 1992. They put it forward as the vision statement, talking about the need for America to impose its will on the world. They also said that they learned from Congress's rejection. They said, Americans won't accept this at face value. You'll need a Pearl Harbor-type event to get the Americans to buy into this. But it also became a political rallying cry against Bill Clinton. Clinton got reelected in 96, and the neoconservatives realized that they had a problem, that they didn't decisively confront Bill Clinton. They didn't build up these critical issues that had to be dealt with from the standpoint of national security. Clinton would be able to aw shucks and gee whiz his way out, and maybe the Democrats would replace him with Al Gore. That's why Iraq suddenly became into problems. Not because Iraq was a threat to the United States of America, but Iraq was a political problem for Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton inherited a political problem from George Herbert Walker Bush called Saddam Hussein's continued survival. Bill Clinton continued a policy that could not succeed of containing Saddam. By 1996, 1997, Saddam's continued survival was an embarrassment the Republicans exploited. That's why in 1998, a Republican-controlled Congress put forward the Iraq Liberation Act, which set forth as public law the removal of Saddam Hussein from power. Bill Clinton signed it. He had no choice, because if he didn't sign it, he'd be accused of being what? Sympathetic to a mad dictator who's likened to Adolf Hitler, called the most evil man on the face of the earth. So how could you not sign a law that said, we want to get rid of Saddam Hussein? The trap was sprung. Now the Republicans come to power. They have to continue down that path that they already built. Get rid of Saddam Hussein. It wasn't about oil. It wasn't about Israel. It was about political power. Saddam Hussein and Iraq were the most easily recognized enemies that had been branded in the psyche of the American people. We were preconditioned for this war by decades of propaganda, and the neoconservatives exploited that. Now that we're in Iraq, we recognize that all that propaganda we were fed was bunk, but it's too late. We got 140,000 Americans in there. We can't withdraw because that'll lead to chaos. But there's also a dangerous world out there. We've been preconditioned now. The mad mullahs of Tehran. How sympathetic can you be to the people who kidnapped Americans, held them hostage in an embassy, the planners behind the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut, the people who were behind bombings around the world? We've been told, I mean, this is another good one, that Osama bin Laden is probably hiding in Iran, that the Islamic Islamo-fascists in Tehran are harboring Osama bin Laden, that the only way we're ever going to hunt down Osama bin Laden is to get into Iran and find him. These are all things. And you know what? As absurd as that statement is, many Americans will accept it at face value because we have been preconditioned to accept anything negative about the Iranians. So if we go to war with Iran, it's not about oil, just about oil. It's not just about Israel. It's about domestic American politics. War is a vehicle of political empowerment for the neoconservative minority, especially in post-9/11 America, where an American people, with all due respect to everybody in this crowd, perhaps you're the exception, but I sadly say that for the most technologically advanced nation on the face of the earth, we are populated by the single most ignorant group of people ever in the modern age. We don't know anything about the world we live in. We don't know anything about our own country. Most people don't know how states interact. They don't know how their own community works. We are ignorant people. And from ignorance comes fear. And when you throw in a 9/11 type event, the ignorant masses are fearful, and they can be led to accept anything. Now the fearful masses are learning the harsh reality of Iraq, but they aren't willing to learn from the mistakes they made leading up to the war in Iraq, and they're repeating the same mistakes with Iran. And the Bush administration is confident that they'll be able to get forward and engage in this war with Iran. And here we are. We accept the press secretary of the White House saying, we shouldn't reflect. I know many Americans have disagreements about why we're in Iraq. Just dismiss that whole debate right there about the illegality of the war, violation of Constitution, etc., and say, but we're there now and we cannot cut and run. And that's why Congress continues to pass huge defense budgets to fund a war that everybody knows is wrong, a war that most people acknowledge can't be won. And based upon that precedent, the Bush administration is confident that if they can engage in Iran, regardless of how disastrous that effort will be, they've trapped the American people yet again. And the beauty of that trap is that our economy will become overwhelmingly focused on waging war, on national security. And then we'll come to what the neoconservatives always wanted. Again, that come-to-Jesus moment where the American people are presented with the ultimate choice. Entitlement programs, Social Security, welfare, Medicaid, or national security, the defense. And we are at war with the Islamists who want to destroy us. And what will happen? We'll support national security and the entitlement programs will go away, and the neoconservatives will be even further empowered. Now, moving on. Air Force Academy. I can't comment on that. I mean, I think it's absurd that that's occurring in a military institution. This would be the equivalent in the 1950s of white supremacists running around and saying that if you're a black American who's gone to the U.S. Military Academy, you know, we're going to give you a racial slur. It's not acceptable. This is a nation of religious tolerance. It's a nation where we separate church from state, and if anybody should know that, it should be a member of the armed services of this country who have taken an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution and who pledged to give their lives in defense. So the fact that you have commissioned officers in the U.S. Air Force Academy today creating a Christian coalition and holding Christianity above, and I'm a Christian. I believe in Jesus, but that's my own personal religion. I don't impose it on anybody. Nor should it be imposed on anybody, and it should never be imposed by somebody wearing the uniform of the United States of America. If I had my way, every officer who had joined such an organization, every officer who had proselytized in such a manner would lose their commission and would lose the right to wear the uniform of the United States of America. Do I think the Democrats have a chance to defeat the Republicans in the 2006 congressional election? No. There is no Democratic Party worthy of the name. You have somebody right now, Howard Dean, as imperfect as he is, at least has the guts to go out and say some things, to get a little confrontational, a little scrappy. And what do mainstream Democrats do? They run away as fast as they can. You know Howard Dean's hitting some points when you got Dick Cheney having to get on national TV to respond to it. The Republicans don't like what he's saying because a lot of what he says is true. A lot of what he says hurts. But a lot of what he says requires courage to stand up and say it and defend it. We got Dick Durbin, who I thought was a man of courage, when he stood up and made some pronouncements about Guantanamo Bay. Yeah, maybe he went over the top. Maybe historically making an analysis between what we do to a couple hundred people and what the Soviets did to millions of people, maybe you can say, well, there, you know, there's a scale issue here. But you know, as an American, as a nation of law, see, we're not the Soviet Union. We're not a dictatorship that basically had, you know, has accepted at face value Lenin and Stalin's ability to snap their finger and condemn 14 million people to death. We're a nation that says we respect the civil liberties and the human dignity of every single human. At least that's what we claim to do. So when people have been imprisoned by the United States of America, even if we torture just one, even if we maltreat just one, it is a crime on the standpoint of its impact to America every bit as big as the crime committed by the Gulag. Durbin was correct, and yet under pressure, without any support from the Democratic Party, he was compelled to make an apology. So with this kind of courage that the Democrats have shown, oh, they don't have a snowball's chance in hell of doing anything in the 2006 election. In fact, if the Democrats continue to behave in this manner, I see the Republicans even further entrenching their way. This is why I say 3 to 4 national election cycles until the American people wake up to the fact that if you voted for the Patriot Act, or if you voted for the war in Iraq, if you have yes votes on those, you have lost the privilege, the trust and confidence of the American people to represent the American people. Until we, the people, start voting these people out and putting in new blood that is respectful of the Constitution. You can't say you're respectful of the Constitution if you voted yes for the Patriot Act. I challenge anybody who voted yes to tell me what the Patriot Act said the moment they cast the vote. They don't know. And yet it was the most sweeping reform of American law in modern times. It infringed on individual civil liberties. Now, a lot of people will say, whose civil liberties did it infringe? Did it infringe on yours? Well, I'm a white male in America. It didn't infringe on mine, at least not that I'm aware of yet. There might be some secret investigations out there with powers, but I'm not worried about those. But it does infringe on an Arab or a Muslim American. And that's not acceptable, because in this country, under the rule of law set forth by the Constitution, if we compromise on one, we've compromised on it all. Because where do you stop? The Constitution cannot be infringed on without due process, and that due process must be done constitutionally. You don't have Congress vote on a document they didn't read that impacts the Constitution, impacts individual civil liberties to this level. And if they voted yes, they got to go or they got to repent. And until the American people demand that and cleanse our representatives of this disease, and that's what it is, the Patriot Act is a disease. It's a disease that eats away at the rule of law, eats away at what defines America. We have to cleanse ourselves, purify ourselves, get rid of these people. Until that happens, we've got problems, and it's going to take time, 3 to 4 political cycles. Who are the Democrats going to put up in 2008? Hillary Clinton? She voted yes for both. Joe Biden? Who? The Democrats don't have anybody they can put up. The Democrats won't put up somebody who's voted no. We saw that with Howard Dean. They will destroy somebody who said no. It'll take another election cycle, another, until we finally get enough new blood in there that who aren't tainted by these votes to where the Democrats can start to be viable players. The other thing is, the Republicans, this may be one of the few good things that emerged from this election. You know, sometimes the most telling cure comes from a test of fire. And a nation, our country is being tested by fire right now. We're going through some pretty darn hard times. But the beauty of it is, we know who to blame now. All right? George W. Bush getting reelected means that he's going to continue down that same path. And we may emerge from this difficult time purging ourselves of the disease of neoconservatism, and that would be a good thing. But again, it's going to take a number of years. I think.
How do you think over 2 to 3 cycles, or 3 to 4 cycles, that it's going to change? How is that going to change?
We don't have a clean election.
I think right now that, how's it going to change? It's not going to happen automatically. I gave a challenge to the peace movement. I give a challenge to everybody. I give a challenge to colleges and universities. I give a challenge to teachers. I give a challenge to firefighters, to policemen. I give a challenge to everybody who calls themselves an American to empower yourself with knowledge and information. But before you start talking about foreign policy and domestic policy and all that, read the Constitution. Read the Constitution. Understand the Constitution. Make sure you know what it is that defines who you are. And if that's not done, then it doesn't matter how many election cycles you go through, there's never going to be a cure. But if you start with the basics and you get people to respect citizenship and the demands of citizenship and the sacrifice citizenship requires, in 3 to 4 political cycles, these citizens will purge the system of the people who don't respect the rule of law set forth by the Constitution. But you're right, it's not just going to happen by itself. It's going to require building this foundation of citizenship that currently does not exist. And the last one is Iran and the U-2. There's no doubt in my mind that U-2 aircraft are taking are doing overflights of Iran. However, if Iran had shot this down, we'd be bombing Iran as we speak. So I don't think the Iranians right now are in a policy of just zero engagement with the United States. They don't want to do anything that will provoke the United States. I think that this plane was doing exactly what the military said it was. It was flying reconnaissance missions in Afghanistan, and tragically, when it came back, it crashed, and an American pilot lost his life.
So I've had a little time, more time to sort the questions, and so we have a bit more distillation for you. This one, is it appropriate to characterize the cooperative integration of church, state, and business, utilizing extensive multimedia propaganda to manipulate public support for militarism as neo-fascism? And about Iraq's cash flow, please speak about the U.S. theft of the Iraqi treasury, its removal to the U.S., its flight to Iraq in cash, and finally, the payment of contractors with this cash, and that's a longer question. And finally, how can a war crimes tribunal be initiated? So all those three questions about corruption, I guess.
Okay. Is it appropriate to characterize the court? I mean, that's a good question. You know, you could spend a semester with graduate students discussing this one to come up with the best answer. What I will say is this is, neo-fascism. Let's just deal with fascism and, let's just use the classic definition of fascism that Benito Mussolini, put out there, one of the all-time fascists. And I believe it was the coming together of the corporate interests and national interests, coming together as a single entity. And you could throw in the church if you wanted to, or religion, and now you would have fascism. I think when you're saying church, state, and business using extensive multimedia propaganda, whoever wrote this is trying to come up with a description of what's occurring in America today. And it's fair. I'm not ready to say that America is a neo-fascist state. First of all, if it was, we wouldn't be here. And we need to respect that and understand that. That as bad and as flawed as this country is, the fact that we're here tonight, the fact that a vocal opponent of this administration is able to speak, the fact that so many vocal opponents of this administration are able to gather here, and these doors aren't being kicked down, speaks volumes to the absolute wonderful character of the country we live in and why we must protect this country so that we can continue to do this, not just here in Massachusetts, but everywhere throughout this country. And right now you can. Everywhere I go in this country, there are meetings like this. So no, we haven't become a fascist state yet. What I call our America, I call it an oligarchy. An oligarchy is where power is in the hands of an elite few. And what's occurred because of this conflict between citizenship and consumerism is because Americans have embraced consumerism, in my mind, they've handed over responsibilities of citizenship to a select few. And they just say, you guys govern the way you best see fit, and we're just going to be over here. As long as you keep us happy, wrap us in that cocoon of comfort, we're not going to rock the boat for you. That's an oligarchy. And that's dangerous because an oligarchy is just one step removed from fascism. An oligarchy is several steps removed from representative democracy. So we're closer to fascism than we are to representative democracy, and that's one of the reasons why we have to struggle so hard to reverse that trend and bring it back. It's very difficult to talk about the pure democratic representative state. We're all human beings. We're all flawed from the basic desire of wanting more. I mean, especially Americans. We're pretty greedy as a people. So it's going to be very difficult to have pure democracy, to have pure citizenship, where Americans wake up every morning and roll up their arms and volunteer. And I volunteer to go out and repair the streets. I volunteer to do this. No. We want to volunteer to go to the beach. We want to volunteer to have a grill. I mean, that's what we like to do. So it's going to be difficult to strike that balance. You can't ask too much of the American people. But what you can demand of them is to read that Constitution, understand that Constitution, and live that Constitution, and hold those whom they elect to higher office responsible to that Constitution. That's the bare minimum we can do as a people. You know, we can still go to the beach and have that grill, too. Theft of Iraqi treasury. Look, guys, there's nothing good I can say about what... Every time I hear that good things are happening in Iraq, I almost get physically ill because there's nothing good happening in Iraq. Iraq is a rape in progress, and I hate to use that word, and please, if anybody in this room is offended by that, I apologize. But the reason why I use that word is because it's exactly what's happening. Iraq as a nation state is being raped in the worst way by the United States. Physically assaulted. Its treasure is being assaulted. Its culture is being assaulted. You know, the United Nations is now putting Iraq on an endangered list in terms of national cultural heritage. We're destroying this war for democracy and liberty that we're waging in Iraq is destroying Iraq's culture. A, through direct assault. You know, one of the neat places that we went to as inspectors, it wasn't all work. Sometimes we had a little bit of fun. And we would drive from Baghdad up to Mosul or Baghdad to Tikrit to do our job. And on the way back, you always pass Samarra. And two things stick out about Samarra. Well, three, actually. It's right on the river. It's beautiful. Green fields, wonderful. Giant gold dome of this great mosque. And then next to it is this spire going up. Ancient. They had a name for it, and I can't remember what it was. I'm typical ignorant American, you know. I don't respect other people's culture, but I know it was there, and I know it was beautiful. And we walked up to the top, and you stood over. And the history was that's where the old caliphate would take their criminals, bring them out, and parade them, and then toss them off into the crowd, and you know, wham. But you'd stand up there and go, whoa, if somebody did that, that would be bad. But it survived history. It was a wonderful piece of history. It was interesting. And what's the United States done? We shell it. We shoot at it. If we see an Iraqi climbing up, we assume they're an observer calling in mortar rounds, and we blow it up. We're destroying it. Archaeology. Anybody who's been involved in archaeological digs understand that, you know, when you find a site, you have to secure the site. You know, what happens if rumor comes out there's a whole bunch of Roman gold coins down there? Well, everybody and their brother wants to go in and get the Roman gold coins, go out and sell them on the black market, ship them off, and there's a huge black market. It's not just about Iraq. It's anywhere in the world. Well, right now in Iraq is, you know, the cradle of civilization. So much history in Iraq, so many archaeological sites that have been identified, etc., none of them are being protected. That history is being looted as we speak, and it's not being dug up by trained professionals who catalog everything for history. It's being ransacked by poverty-stricken people who have no choice, no alternative, than to go in there and break in and grab as much as they can and try and sell it on the black market. Iraq is being destroyed. Tribal society. You know, where people sit down in the evening with their elders, and whether we respect this or not, you know, Iraq is not a Jeffersonian democracy. They don't have Vermont town meetings, but they do have a meeting of the clans. They do have a meeting, and it's very democratic. People get to air their grievances. When you sit down in one of these tribal meetings, when it's your turn to speak, everybody must listen. And not just listen, but they have to give credence to what you say. They can't just dismiss it, because there's this rule of honor. If a man steps forward and speaks, he must be heard, and his words must be listened to. There has to be some compromise made. It's a wonderful thing. That doesn't happen anymore. Oh, gosh, if the tribal guys get together, that's a gathering of insurgents, and we blow them up. We raid them. We imprison them. Iraq is being destroyed. Their oil is being ransacked. You think oil is being used to pay for the rebuilding of Iraq? Oil is being used to pay for contractors, American contractors in Iraq. There's not even being enough oil being pumped out to pay for it. Everybody talks about this as a war for oil. The Iraqis aren't pumping hardly any oil. Every time they get a pipeline up, the insurgents blow it up again. Hardly any oil is getting pumped out there. So who's paying for oil? For a while there, Iraq had to import oil. Imagine that. One of the world's second largest proven reserves of oil. In order to have enough oil, you have to import it. Import oil. When I was in Iraq, you could zip right up to a gas station and you could get your gasoline for about 2 cents a gallon. I mean, it was the cheapest gasoline on the face of the earth. You just flow in there. You didn't, and again, it shows the cultural insensitivity of Americans, and I'm not proud of this, but you know, the Iraqis who worked for a living would count out every dinar and give it and demand change. Well, spoiled Americans, we come in there, spoiled UN people, I should say, it wasn't just Americans. But, you know, we exchange our dollars, we get a big wad of Iraqi dinar, and we'd roll up the gas station, fill up our thing, just grab a couple inches worth, toss it to the kid, and walk out, and, you know, thinking that we're doing so good. We didn't realize how much we're insulting the kid, probably, for what we're doing. But the point is, gas was cheap. Gas was plentiful. Today, people have to stand in line for 5 days to get gas. They aren't even allowed to fill up their cars, just to get a little bit of gas. Power outages all the time. If there weren't backup generators in the green zone wouldn't have electricity. Baghdad is rationing power, and yet good things are happening in Iraq. So, you know, we sit here and we talk about, you know, the dollars. Yeah, it's dramatic to speak of the dollars. I think there's a news story that came out about the tons of dollars that were flown from the Fed in New York City into Iraq on the last day of the Iraqi National, you know, the before Paul Bremer handed over power. We sent in something like $2.4 billion in $100 bills. It required a special airplane to fly it in and all this stuff, and then it was just sort of thrown out to the Iraqis, and then we walked away, and there was no accounting for it. How many people know that $8 billion of Iraqi money is unaccounted for, thanks to Paul Bremer? We sit here and talk about the oil for food scandal. Saddam Hussein, in 10 years, stole $1.2 billion. Paul Bremer, in 11 months, stole $8 billion. Americans do it better. You know, it's stunning. So yeah, there's this huge problem going. There's no accountability right now. Iraq is the wild, wild west. We continue to pour money into Iraq. A lot of the defense money that we vote on gets reapportioned. So Congress sits there and votes for money to this program, but once it gets into the Pentagon, Rumsfeld can sort of carve it out and spend it on anything he wants to with zero accountability. Halliburton can charge extraordinary funds for food for our troops to eat. When they get caught overbilling, they just ask for a redactment, and there's no penalty or is a minor penalty. So, yeah, there's a huge problem going. But trust me, the problem with Iraq is much greater than dollars. If it were just dollars, you know, I really wouldn't care. But we're destroying a nation. We're destroying a culture, a history. We're destroying a people. Imagine an Iraqi child growing up today. You want to know why the Iraqi insurgency functions so well? Because the guys who are fighting right now, those 20-year-olds that are taking us on now, it's 2005. They were 10-year-olds in 1995. They were 10 years old when Madeleine Albright got on CBS News and was confronted with the figure of 500,000 dead Iraqi children because of U.S.-led economic sanctions against Iraq. And she said, that's a price we're willing to pay. Well, you know what? It's not a price the Iraqis are willing to pay. And those 10-year-olds knew that. The guys who were 10-year-old when the United States invaded are 25 years old. So the guys of fighting age right now have grown up hating America, despising America. And every Iraqi that's born now, every Iraqi that's reaching adulthood now, hates America and will fight and die to get America out of their country. But is that a childhood? Is that a life? Are we raising kids that are going to become quality members of the global community? Or are we raising hardened killers who are going to be a problem for the world and who are going to raise their own generation of hardened killers? What we're doing in Iraq goes well beyond dollars. How can a war crimes tribunal be initiated? It never will be, and I'll tell you why. It should be. It should be. But I will be the first to tell you that I will not support a war crimes tribunal. And the reason why is that a war crimes tribunal will destroy this country. Because we can't have a war crimes tribunal without going, I mean, once you initiate that action, you know, the Nuremberg trials condemned the Nazi regime. It basically destroyed Germany. And Germany had to be rebuilt with a new constitution, etc. I like our constitution. But if we have a war crimes tribunal and we execute it in accordance to the rule of law, it is not limited to the President of the United States. It is not limited to his administration. It will reach down into Congress. It will reach down into the judiciary. It'll reach down into every aspect of American society.
Yeah.
And, well, then you destroy America.
That's not a good idea.
I'm not a big fan of destroying the country that I'm willing to give my life for. You can't destroy America without destroying the Constitution.
Why can't you just put the criminals in jail and take the country back?
Because you can't. The question is, how can you get a war crimes tribunal?
Right.
A war crimes tribunal is all or nothing. You can't do it halfway, or else it's a joke.
We're not criminals. They're criminals.
And who's going to try them?
Well, I'm going to challenge you. Can I challenge you?
Feel free.
Peace movement didn't do their thing.
Yeah.
We lost the first battle. Historically in America, and you're a soldier.
Marine.
Historically in America, when peace doesn't work, we call on the troops. You got an army to lend us?
God, you never want American troops involved in the politics of the United States of America. Our job is to defend the Constitution. Our job is not to wage war against our own citizens. And never ask an American soldier to do that. That's the job of the American citizen. If you want to raise arms, I have to tell you, that's a dangerous thing. Because raising arms is sedition. You're going against the Constitution. The rule of law is absolute. If we're going to have a war crimes tribunal, it must be conducted in accordance with the rule of law. And I believe, my personal opinion, is that such a tribunal would destroy this country. We're better off voting out the son of a gun and letting history condemn him and repairing the mess ourselves. No matter how nice it might be to have a war crimes tribunal, you're not. Because you know what? Once you start down that path, you're going to have to try Bill Clinton. You're going to have to try every American president. You're going to have to try most members of Congress, because these crimes are not unique to George W. Bush. He has taken them and magnified them and enlarged them, but we have had presidents violating the Constitution in the conduct of foreign policy for decades. And where do you stop? Where do you stop? I think it's better for us to talk about drawing a line, voting them out, and moving forward. But I don't believe, this is my personal opinion, that a war crimes tribunal would be beneficial to the United States.
Well, we differ. We're willing to differ. We have questions waiting in line here. Are you for bringing the troops home now? What can we do to keep the National Guard home? And is it true that we have or are building 8 military bases in Iraq as reported about 6 months ago?
My favor bringing the troops home now? Yes. The only solution is to bring home right now. The analogy I use is Iraq. Iraq is a nation on fire. The fuel that feeds the fire is the presence of American troops. The only way to put that fire out is to separate the fuel from the flame, get the fuel home right here where it belongs. It doesn't belong over in Iraq. Iraq is an illegal war. The occupation is illegal. Every American soldier, sailor, airman, and Marine who dies in Iraq is a death in vain. They are not defending the Constitution. They are not defending national security. They are simply dying. And because we get to that issue of war crimes, you know, it's like a German dying in World War II. It doesn't matter how honorable you were or what medals you won. You died in support of an illegal war. Americans are dying in support of an illegal war in Iraq, and we should not ask the armed forces to bear this shame any longer. It's not their fault that they're there. It's our fault, and it's our fault that they continue to be there. We need to bring them home, and tragically, that's not going to happen for some time. As I said, this is a 3-4 election cycle. I believe our troops are there for another generation. But you asked me the question, do I want them home now? Yes. Today is the best day that Iraq's going to have. Tomorrow's going to be worse. The day after tomorrow is going to be worse. It's not going to get better. So the argument that we must keep American troops in Iraq in order to prevent chaos and anarchy from breaking out is a flawed argument. Chaos and anarchy has already broken out. And the reason why it's breaking out is the presence of American troops. Get them home now. National Guard. Do I think there's a role for the National Guard? Personally speaking, I think the National Guard should be disbanded. I don't think there's a role for the National Guard. Well, wait a minute, but what about wildfires out west? It's not a soldier's job to fight wildfires. If you want to fight wildfires, build a larger fire department. Build hotshot crews. You call them firefighters. But don't call them soldiers. The National Guard is basically a welfare program. And that's what we're finding out today. They're not trained professionals. When they go over into Iraq, they don't know how to fight. They're getting killed because of their incompetence. And they're killing Iraqis because of their incompetence. I'm not trying to denigrate their bravery. But anybody who has observed the National Guard in action understand that these boys and girls have the foggiest clue what they're doing when it comes time to close with and destroy the enemy in a complicated situation like the insurgency in Iraq. The British Army, and again, I'm not defending what they did in Ireland, but the British Army, before they would send troops, they learned from the mess, you know, Bloody Sunday, etc. Before they would send troops in, they would take a battalion and spend 6 months training that battalion purely on counterinsurgency operations and police operations. How did that battalion operate in downtown Belfast? Well, they didn't rush out a building and form a 180-degree circle and fill every bullet full of bullet holes. That's what the National Guard does. The British would walk downtown with their helmets removed, engage with the people, move out, be amongst the people. They were more police than they were soldiers. And eventually, the level of violence ratcheted down. Again, I'm not defending the British occupation of Ireland. I'm just saying that that is the only way a military presence has a chance of stabilizing. Notice I didn't say succeed, because the British didn't succeed in Northern Ireland, not through the force of arms. And America will never succeed in Iraq through the force of arms. But the National Guard is simply not up to the task. Therefore, why do we have a National Guard? The National Guard should be dissolved, and we should focus on an all-volunteer professional military force. Why do I say this? Because if you're going to go to war, you got to win. If you're going to go to war, you got to win. A conscript military cannot prevail in a modern battlefield the way we need it to prevail. The day of putting Marines across the beach at Iwo Jima and losing 5,000 Marines and saying that that's acceptable is over with. If we go to war, we must win overwhelmingly. We must have the best equipment, the best trained people, the best leaders, so that when we engage, it's a one-sided conflict. It will be awful. It will be horrible. Many people will die, hopefully many more of them than us. That's what war is. And because this force we're going to have is so terrible, and every American should understand just how terrible this force is, we'll be repulsed to ever use it. We'll realize that we won't treat it lightly. It won't be a joke. It'll be serious. When we say, hey, if we're going to hit the on switch on this, man, bad stuff is going to happen. Maybe there's got to be an alternative to switching the on switch. Maybe we can seek nonviolent resolution to issues. That's why I like all professional force of killers, trained killers, because if we don't recognize what they are, we'll be more likely to use them. The second we think that, man, sending in the military is not a big deal. National Guard, they're just hometown boys like us. No, stop viewing them that way. When you put on the uniform of the United States military, you're a trained killer, because that's the only reason to have a military. To wage war and destroy the enemy. And once you recognize just how horrible this thing is, just how well-trained these killers are, just what war is, you may not want to go to war. And that's why I want an all-volunteer force.
So we have some questions about the peace movement, please. How do we show that the truth matters? As a country, we seem to have accepted the idea that the story is of much greater importance than the truth. How do we show others that the story does not serve us? The truth is difficult, and yet willfully turning from it leads to deeper disaster. How do we ask people to make this choice? A little bit of other strategy questions about the peace movement. Can we deal with the constant, fast-moving, go-for-the-jugular ruthlessness of the war movement? Can the peace movement ever? And lastly, do you have any suggestions for how the peace movement can create a dialogue with those who support or use or are ambivalent about the war with Iraq? So I know we're taxing you for lots of great thinking, and please just take what you want to touch upon.
Well, I'll just start by saying that I'm going to give you my ideas, but here's the danger of public speaking. You know, I didn't want to be a public speaker. I like to play golf. I like to be with my kids. I like to fish. I like to do a lot of things. I don't like to speak publicly, but it's something that I had to do on the issue of Iraq because I knew something about Iraq. I was empowered with information that was not readily available to most Americans. So I took to public speaking as a vehicle of educating, of trying to empower people with knowledge and information. Unfortunately, when you stand before a microphone and people think you got your act together on one subject, they assume you have your act together on a whole variety of subjects. And I'm here to tell you right now, I don't. So I'll be more than happy to talk to you, but please take what I'm about to say and give it as much weight as you would give, you know, anybody here. I am not some sort of visionary of the peace movement. I'm as confused about this issue as everybody in this room is. First of all, I'm not a good member of the peace movement. I'm not a pacifist. I'm a warrior. I'm one of these guys that would still join the military today. I'm one of these guys that would still readily go to war today. I'm one of these guys that would still kill today. I'm not a member of the peace movement. I like peace. I want peace. I cherish peace. And I'm willing to fight and die to get peace. Does that make any sense? No. So you already have a flawed person up here talking to you about the peace movement to begin with. So, you know, I'm still in a transitional phase here. Still got a lot of Marine Corps blood in my body. So it's a tough thing here. But one of the things I think we can agree on is the power of truth. And what makes the truth important? And it's difficult, the truth, because the truth is never black and white. The truth is never absolute. The truth is subject to interpretation. The truth can be nuanced. The truth can be a number of things. But what the truth can't be is a lie, okay? And we know what a lie is. I mean, it's very easy to know what a lie is. A lie is wrong. A lie is false. But truth, what is truth? I mean, I can believe that, you know, if I lived in a cave and someone told me that the sky was pink, or sometimes the sky is pink, so we have to be careful. The sky was psychic. Well, it is sometimes. The sky was, I don't know, give me a color that the sky never is. The sky was a unique color. And I was educated the sky was this color. But I've never been outside to see the sky. But if someone said, what color is the sky? I'd say this. Am I telling the truth? Yes. Am I wrong? Absolutely. But it's not a lie. It's the truth. So the truth is a difficult thing. What is truth? We got to be careful about saying, I want the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. What you should say is just don't lie to me. All right? Just don't lie to me. And that's what more I put the emphasis on, so much about the power of truth. Because, you know, there's a lot of people out there who disagree with a lot of what you believe in. But they're not liars. They believe it's the truth. They believe in the truth. It's just a matter of education. That's why empowerment through the acquisition of knowledge is so important. The more knowledge you acquire, the more truth you possess. Not because it's absolute, but at least you know what it isn't. You know it's not a lie. Did you break this pencil? You either did or you didn't. Yes or no? You know, it's that. So you got to be careful about the truth. But what I will tell you is by making sure that you don't embrace a lie, by making sure that you don't lie, history will treat you well. And the peace movement needs to view what's going on in a larger scale. Yeah, the pro-war crowd today is the gladiator crowd. It's the Colosseum crowd. You know, they wanted to go in and kill people. And again, I don't want to bring in religion, but, you know, early Christians going to Rome. Man, you didn't want to be a Christian in Rome then, because you got fed to the lions, you got burned, you got crucified, bad things happened to you. You had the go for the throat crowd coming after you the whole time. But you know what? Roman Empire is gone. And Christianity's still here because they believed in something. They believed in something that was a core value, and they persevered. The peace movement needs to have a core value. The peace movement needs to develop a core value. What does the peace movement stand for? What do you stand for? And it's got to be something that everyone in America can embrace. And that's why I say the Constitution. Because if you say peace, what is peace? You know, I'm here tonight and I'm sympathetic to what you believe in, but we don't necessarily agree on everything. But I do think we agree on the rule of law set forth by the Constitution. At least most of us would agree on that. That the Constitution is a pretty good document. It's not a perfect document, but it's a good document. In the country that it theoretically represents could be a great country. And we want to make it that great country. So if the peace movement rallied around that and made that its defining moment, who gives a damn what Sean Hannity says tonight? Who cares what Donald Rumsfeld does tomorrow? Because in the large scheme of things, they are but a blip in the screen. It's a painful blip. It's not an easy blip to endure. But believe me, history is going to condemn these people. They are not going to be recorded as good people. And America is a nation that will hopefully live a lot longer than Sean Hannity. The peace movement is comprised of humans who, like Sean Hannity, are going to go away. Individually, we may not account for much. But if we come together as a group, we have a core value, and we seek to educate people on this core value to bring in people, the peace movement will have a lasting effect. We've already blown it on Iraq, and it's not the peace movement's fault. I don't mean to blame the peace movement. Iraq is a manifestation of the disease of consumerism that has taken over America. Iran will be another manifestation. There will be another conflict after that and another conflict after that. And the peace movement can't stop it because you're not the cure for cancer, at least not the immediate cure for cancer. But the peace movement, if you embrace the concept of constitutional-based citizenship, can be the cure for cancer. It's going to take time. It's going to take a purging of the system. It's going to take a purging of the process. But, you know, 20 years from now, if you guys can rally around a central cause, if you can build a coalition worthy of the name of coalition, if you can reach out and bring in people who might not be of the same ideology as you, but at least you agree on this core value, the peace movement will be, you know, viewed by historians. Whatever peace movement you can build, whatever peace movement we can build, will be viewed by historians is the thing that turned America around. We're going through a tough time as a country. This is going to be a dark, dark period of American history. But 100 years now, when kids are reading the history books, hopefully they'll be talking about the birth of a peace movement that helped turn America around and once again made it this shining mansion on the hill that the rest of the world could be proud of and Americans could be proud of. How do you reach out? You know, you say how they can create a dialogue with those who support or are ambivalent about the war in Iraq. I'll just give you one theme that I put out there that I was confronted by this in Washington State, where you have a lot of, it's a strong union town, strong union state, and especially in Olympia, you got this big port, and man, they had depression like you wouldn't believe in this port, and suddenly the war comes up, and the ships start shipping things out, and the economy's booming, and now how do you get the trade union to be against the war? Trade union sitting there going, this sucks, this war. People are dying, but you know what? I'm making more money than I've ever made in my life. Things are good. How do you get them to be against the war? It's a tough one. And the problem is that you're attacking them at the most difficult point. You know, every pacifist needs to read Clausewitz. Every pacifist needs to read Sun Tzu. These are great thinkers of war. And it's something I said in leading up to war in Iraq. I said, I'm waging peace. And what I meant by that is I'm running a campaign for peace with the same intensity, the same focus that a military officer runs a campaign for war. You have to do the same evaluation. You may be pacifist, but understand there's an enemy out there. There's an enemy. The enemy is that there's those who are proponents of war. And you have to view them as the enemy, which means you have to start doing evaluation of their critical mass, of the weakness. Where are they weak? You don't hit them where their strengths are. You hit them where their weaknesses is. You want to win some people over. The Veterans for Foreign Wars, the American Legion. Man, those are two groups that you just would think would never be in bed with the peace movement. You know, they think you guys are a bunch of tree-hugging, you know, Birkenstock-wearing. Well, you are a bunch of tree-hugging Birkenstock-wearing. But they're against. They're fundamentally, you know, they seem to be fundamentally against you. But you know what? They're not. They're not, actually. But see, their ideology, they're trapped in their ideology, and they think you're trapped in your ideology. The question is, how do you bridge that? What are they really angry about right now, the VFW and the American Legion? They're angry about veterans' rights. They're angry about the medical care the veterans are getting. They're angry about the Bush administration's hypocritical betrayal of the American veteran. They are really mad about that. What are you guys mad about? You're mad about wounded Americans and dead Americans. We're all sickened by this young kid who was this vision of vitality going off to Iraq and coming back destroyed, either killed, maimed, psychologically damaged. Either way, you don't come back from Iraq normal. And this country has betrayed every single one of them. Every single one of them. Now, how do you start building a coalition? Maybe you recognize that you have this potential bridging right there. You go to the VFW. Now, you got to be smart about this. You don't go with the big peace sign and the big Birkenstock around the crowd to the VFW and say, embrace us, brothers. No. You have to, you know, find somebody that at least maybe looks. There's a guy with a coat and a tie, you know. So you send the guy with the tie to the VFW. And you don't call yourself the peace movement. You say that you are citizens concerned about veterans care. and you go in and you talk to them, and you build this bridge, you initiate this discussion. It's not meant to be deliberately deceiving. You don't want to lie to them. Never lie. They ask, are you with the pacifists or whatever? You say, yes, we are. But we're not here to talk about those issues. We're here to make common cause about veterans' affairs. And you know, once you engage them on veterans' affairs, once you sit down at the table, because I have done it, I'm a member of the American Legion. And I have sat down in the bar with the Legionnaires. And believe me, during the height of the Iraq War, it was Scott Ritter on one side and the rest of the Legion on the other, and they just stared at me. But every Wednesday, I would go to the American Legion and quiet the place down, sit down at the bar, order out my beer, drink my beer, stare them all down, and leave. Just to say, I am a member too. And gradually, as they began to say, well, God, there are no WMD. And they would come up and they go, man, you were right. There was no WMD. Suddenly, a couple of them would come over. Next year, now, when I walk the American Legion, Scott, how you doing? Sit down and talk. And we can talk. And we talk about a lot of things. And one of the things that we agree on is how awfully our veterans are being treated. And you know what? There's more anti-war people in my American Legion post than you could possibly imagine. But it wouldn't have happened had I just barged down the door and said, anti-war. They would say, go to hell. That's exactly what it done. They had to build that bridge. And you can build that bridge. It takes time. But once you get the American Legion, the VFW on your side, on that one issue, once you get them focusing on that veteran, they're going to focus on why that veteran was wounded. They're going to focus on the reason. You don't have to preach to them. You just have to be there when they realize that this maimed soldier, sailor, airman, marine, was maimed in a cause not worthy of the sacrifice. Just be there when they have this moment of self-realization and you have just created an ally. And you do that. You identify every segment. Don't be in their face. Make common cause, maybe at the easiest bridge. But once you make that common cause, because your cause is so just, because the cause of supporting this war is so wrong, you will win. You will prevail. But you can't be in your face. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people, and I'm an in-your-face kind of guy too on some things, and that's why I don't build coalitions very effectively. But there's a lot of people that don't understand that, you know, you may be trapped in the 60s or 70s, but the American Legion isn't. And they're not going to come to you. You got to make compromises. There's got to be compromises of substance, but you know, compromises of presentation. And if you do that, you'll be surprised how broad of a coalition you truly can build. And you know what? You'll never have a problem convincing the American Legion and the Veterans of Foreign War that the Constitution is a foundational document. They're automatically on your side. And there's no better thing than to have a veteran take a group of school kids to a cemetery and help them put flags on a cemetery in Memorial Day to underscore the cost of conflict. I mean, these are people who are invaluable to your cause, the cause of peace, because what is the cause of peace? The cause of peace is about what we all want as human beings. No parent wants their child to be, you know, to be brought up in a neighborhood that's filled with crime, filled with hate, filled with violence. No parent wants their child brought up just to die in a war. No parent wants to bury their child. So every parent is on your side. You just have to find a way to make common cause with the parent. There's not a veteran worth their salt. Not a vet. Now, you know, in the Marine Corps, we had that 10% rule. Well, we called it the 20% rule. We had 10% that were just perfect Marines. No matter what, these guys were perfect. They could do everything right, never do anything wrong. You had 10%, no matter what, they were the scumbags. They were criminals. They would steal from you, rob you blind, etc. The veterans are the same way. You got your perfect veterans, you got your scumbags, and then you got that 80% in the middle of just normal people like you and I. There might be some good guys out here. I don't know. I don't mean to be prejudicial. I'm in that 80%. But there are some veterans out there that will proclaim the glory of war. War is great. It's the best thing that ever happened to me, going to war. Hey, I killed so many bad guys. Well, you know what? If you dig deep enough, you'll find out that guy was probably shuffling paper in some rear area and he never saw combat. You won't find a World War II veteran that went over the beach in Normandy that'll sit there and talk about how many Germans he killed. Most of your veterans came home and they didn't want to talk about the war at all. You know why? Because there's nothing glorious in war. There's nothing wonderful about it. They were scared to death and they knew it. They knew that war was horrible. Every veteran shares that. Anybody who's seen combat shares that hatred of war, that absolute hatred of war. These are natural allies. These are natural allies of the peace movement. You just got to find a way to build that bridge. You can't confront them. You can't insult them. You can't, you know, you can't tear down what they believe in. These are people who believe in a strong military. I think the best thing the peace movement could do is support a strong military. And again, if you use the logic that I put forward, you support a strong military because you want to create something that can never be used. Never be used. But if you support a strong military, you've already nullified the argument that the right wing uses against the peace movement. Bunch of pacifists, you want America to roll over and play dead. You know what? No, you don't. You don't want America to roll over and play dead. But you don't want America to go around killing other people either. You want a responsible America, America that operates domestically and internationally in accordance with the rule of law. And the rule of law, as we all know, isn't about cops running around giving everybody a hug. The rule of law has cops carrying guns, carrying sticks, and if bad guys are out there, the cops apprehend the bad guys, and the bad guys get processed in accordance with the rule of law. We're not talking about anarchy here. We have to recognize that the world is a difficult place. There's some bad people out there. Those bad people might want to do us harm, and we have to be prepared to defend ourselves. But it doesn't mean, just because we're prepared to defend ourselves, doesn't mean that we preemptively defend ourselves. It doesn't mean that we dictate to the rest of the world. If the peace movement can find a way to incorporate a national security strategy that speaks of a viable military, a strong military that embraces that, you've nullified one of the biggest weaknesses that you have. Because I'm here to tell you that Main Street America isn't going to turn its back on its military. Just isn't going to happen. Not in this generation. Not in the next generation. So you've got to find that way to build that bridge. Those are just my thoughts. I don't mean to say that it's the gospel.
It's getting late.
That was Scott Ritter in dialogue with members of the peace community in Western Massachusetts. Thanks to the Trap Rock Peace Center for that recording. You can visit them online at www.traprockpeace.org. And you can download an MP3 of this show from our archive at unwelcomeguests.org. This is Seattle-based singer-songwriter Jim Page.
When Johnny comes home again, we'll all go out and welcome him. Never mind the shape he's in. And we'll ask him how the fighting went. We'll ask him how the fighting went. We'll ask him how the fighting went and how he likes the president. Casualties are an accident. And we'll beat our drums and wave our flags. We'll beat our drums and wave our flags. We'll beat our drums and wave our flags as great and grand and glorious rags. The ones they put in the body bag. And later on when the sickness comes, later on when the sickness comes, later on when the sickness comes from chemicals and uranium, we'll wring our hands and we'll all play dumb. See the old veterans who did their part. The veterans who did their part. The veterans who did their part and came back home with a purple heart. Walking around with a shopping cart. See where are the legs that used to run? Where are the legs that used to run? Where are the legs you used to run before you went to carry a gun? Well, I'm afraid your dancing days are done. You have no arm, you have no leg. You have no arm, you have no leg. You have no arm, you have no leg. You're an armless, legless, chickenless egg. We'll have to put you out with a bowl to beg. Your hat and take a bow. Tip your hat and take a bow. Tip your hat and take a bow and get on with your life somehow. We're taking your little brother now.